excited, Bruce said. He tries to run if I don't watch him.
Chet grunted, threw away the oiled rag, and replaced the bolt in the gun. Bruce was nutty. He'd rather stick around and watch his old colt than go out and do anything. Chet spit off the porch and went in to hang the ramrod on its nail. His mother was looking at the calendar.
He doesn't stop to think how a person might worry, she said.
Huh?
Your dad should have been home day before yesterday. Where's he gone? After more whiskey?
She looked at him long and steadily, and her mouth moved as if she had something bad tasting in it.
Chet, she said, you don't ever talk about what Pa's doing, do you?
No, I know better than that.
I hope you do. Don't say anything to anybody.
She laughed and shook her head.
I guess that's one trouble. A person can't talk to anybody. Where were you going?
Oh, out.
Run up to the post office and get the mail before you go.
Give me 2 bits?
What for?
I need some cartridges. These old BBs are no good for anything. If I saw a rabbit, I'd need longs.
All right.
Chet followed her into the dining room.
Can I have a dime for some chocolate bars, too?
Why a dime? Won't nickels buy anything anymore?
Well, a nickel, then.
She gave him a quarter and a nickel, and as he went out, he was thinking that it was kind of good to have Pa gone. He crabbed when you asked for money. Ma was better about things like that. He was carrying the gun as he went uptown, and by the time he reached the post office, he had picked up Bill Stenhouse and Pete Armstrong. Pete had his Daisy pump gun, and Bill had no gun at all. Chet felt both superior and magnanimous, letting them tag along. There was no mail except a letter from Aunt Kristen from Minnesota. In McGregor's Hardware, Chet bought a box of longs, and at Henderson's Drug, while he took a long time deciding what kind of chocolate bar he wanted, Pete swiped a package of spearmint gum, and Bill got a vial of perfume. They clotted briefly outside around the corner to count their wealth and decide where they were going.
"I got to take this letter home," Chet said. "Come on, I'll make Bruce lend us his old .22. He's going to stay home anyway."
He left Bill and Pete leaning on the fence, looking critically at the crippled colt, while he took the letter inside.
"Oh, good," his mother said automatically, seeing the return address. "Nothing from Pa?"
"That was all," Chet said. "Ma, can Pete and Bill and me have a little lunch to take along hunting?"
"I suppose so. You want me to fix it?"
"I'll fix it."
Chet sliced off some thick slabs of bread, buttered them, found 3 doughnuts gummed with powdered sugar, and dropped them all in a bag. From the cellarway he got Bruce's .22.
"Brucey," he said out the door, "can we borrow your gun?"
"No," Bruce said.
He had been quarreling with Bill and Pete, who said the colt would always be an old wreck that couldn't walk. Bruce was almost crying.
"No, sir," he said. "You leave my gun alone." "Give you a stick of gum for the loan of it," Pete said.
"No."
2 sticks.
"No."
"Oh, come on, Brucey," Chet said. "You aren't going to be using it." "I'm not going to lend it anyway."
Chet came clear out on the step.
"What do you want to be so stingy for? We won't hurt your old blunderbuss."
"If it's an old blunderbuss," Bruce said, "what do you want to borrow it for?"
"I'll punch your nose in a minute," Chet said.
He started out, but his mother's voice stopped him.
"Let him alone," she said. "If he doesn't want to lend it, that's his right."
The 3 started away.
"I know where you little squirts got your shanty," Chet said. "Wait and see what happens to that."
"You leave it alone," Bruce yelled after them. "If you touch that shanty, I'll drop rocks through your old boat."
"You do, and you'll get your nose busted," Chet said.
He walked with long, leather-stocking strides, and the others fell into single file behind him, walking in his footprints. Bill, having no gun to occupy his hands, took out his snitched vial of perfume and began dosing his shirt front. A half hour later, in the exciting, growth-heavy spring wind, the 3 sat on pinnacles of the sandhills halfway up the bench and looked down over the river valley, the looping brown river, the willows fresh green, the valley grass a deeper, brighter green, the houses sharp-edged in the strong light. On both sides of the washed-out railroad bridge, Chet saw the black dots of men moving, and the railroad itself, the double line of rails and the crisscross of ties and the spiderweb lines of fences along the right-of-way, was drawn straight east and west along the valley. Hooking his legs around the sandpapery stone of his pinnacle, he twisted to look back of him at the slope. The aspen came down in three bright tongues, one behind the summer cottage of Howard Palmer, one directly behind the sandhills, and one behind the shanty of Tex Davis. Tex was a cowpuncher who came and went, appearing sometimes in the spring and staying a few weeks, then disappearing again, nobody knew where. Some said he followed the rodeos and stampedes. Others said he was a road agent. Chet had peeked into the one window of the shack plenty of times, but his peeks had told him nothing except that Tex was a dirty old buzzard and never swept his floor. He turned again, looking out across the railroad to Heathcliff's place at the bottom, across Heathcliff's to Purcell's Dam. The air blew across him, warm and soft, and all around the bottom of the pinnacles the ground was misty purple with crocuses. He could smell sweet pea perfume floating across from the peak where Bill perched.
"There goes somebody on a bike," Bill said.
Chet looked and saw the smooth, floating motion of the wheel, the blaze of a white shirt as it caught the sun.
"It must be Frankie Buck," he said. "Old man Lipscomb must have given him Saturday off."
He took a firm grip with his legs, shot off his .22 into the air, yelled, "Hey, Frankie!" Pete and Bill yelled, too, and the figure below, almost a mile away, stopped moving. The white-shirted arm waved, and they yelled to him to come up. Frankie rolled along to the gate where Angus MacLeod's road came across the tracks and came walking his wheel through. He left both gates wide open as he started up. Chet and Bill and Pete slid down off the pinnacles and went over to Tex's shack to meet him. He was puffing when he came up the hill, and his stockings had slid down, leaving his bow legs bare. Frankie was adopted by Mr. Lipscomb, who ran the ledger, and he had to work a lot, setting type and delivering.
"Hi," he said. "What you kids doing?"
"Horsing around," Chet said.
"How come you don't have to work?"
"I have to this aft," Frankie said. "Have you shot anything?"
"Chet couldn't hit anything if we saw it," Pete said.
"Oh, couldn't I?" Chet said.
He looked around for something to shoot at, found an old demijohn behind the shack, and set it up on a fence post. From 50 feet away, he aimed and fired. There was a spang, but the demijohn didn't break. Pete haw-hawed.
"Well, I only had a BB in," Chet said. "I hit it, didn't I?"
"I can do as good as that with my air gun," Pete said.
He pumped his gun and shot, and again there was a noise, a higher, lighter noise. Sping! The demijohn was still intact.
"You guys are terrible," Frankie said. "Leave me have a shot, Chet."
He shot and missed. Then Bill shot and missed. Chet slipped along into the .22 and waved them back.
"Let me show you how it's done," he said.
He shot high and broke the neck off the jug. Bill and Frankie started pegging rocks at it, and in a minute it was in a dozen pieces. Inside was the dried body of a mouse.
"Look at that," Frankie said, picking it up by the tail. "I bet he died happy."
He threw the mouse at Pete, who fell on him. They wrestled till they were both winded and lay sprawling on the warm ground. Then they were all lying on the ground, looking up into the empty, pale, sunny sky. Pete lifted his head as if that was all the strength he had left.
"Gosh, I'm hungry," he said.
So they ate the sandwiches and split the doughnuts and the chocolate bar and all had a drink at the spring behind the shack. On the way back, Frankie chinned himself up to the high little window and peeked in. He banged his hand against the sash, and the sash gave a little.
"Hey," he said. "I bet we could get in here."
He pried and hammered at the sash, but it wouldn't give far enough to give him any leverage.
"Stand back for a minute," Chet said. "I bet I move her."
He jammed the gun butt against the side, but the butt slipped, and there was a shattering tinkle of glass. Chet pulled back and looked at the others. Bill looked scared. Frankie and Pete looked as if they didn't know how to look.
"Now you've did it," Bill said.
"Oh, hell," Chet said.
He reached up the barrel and knocked another of the four lights out. In an instant, the other kids were clattering and banging and pounding, and the window was a total loss. Excitement was in them now.
"Give me a boost," Frankie said.
He jumped for the sill, but Chet pulled him down.
"I busted the window first. I get to go in first."
There was an argument, but Pete gave him a hand, and he popped his head into the musty twilight of the shanty. He picked the glass out of the road, got his leg over, and slid inside to the littered floor. He was hunting plunder before Pete's face was in the window, and he had found the horse pistol before Pete was halfway inside. With the treasure in his hand, he snapped the door lock and let in a flood of sun. The pistol was an enormous single-action Colt 44 with a great arching wooden butt. It was so heavy that he needed two hands to aim it. The other kids crowded around and wanted to handle it, but he kept them off. It was his prize. And it was even loaded, 5 shells in it and the hammer carefully down on the empty chamber. Chet broke it and looked through the barrel. Clean. Pete and Frankie were turning the shanty upside down, looking for more, but Bill was a little scared. He said, "You ain't going to keep it, are you, Chet?" The word touched Chet's mind briefly. Stealing. But the gun was in his hands, ponderous, heavy, a real honest-to-goodness man-sized six-shooter. "You bet your life," he said. The other two, having found nothing but a rusty butcher knife and some tin dishes, were looking under the bunk. Pete lifted the mattress, and field mice dropped and scattered.
"Whee!"
Frankie yelled. He leaped sideways out of a half-dozen twittering, frantic mice that skittered and scurried and hid and popped out again and jumped up and down. Frankie grabbed an old alarm clock almost as he jumped, and as he alighted he turned and threw it. The thing smashed like a bomb, scattering glass and hands and wheels and springs halfway across the room.
"Oh, Lordy," Bill moaned.
He stood back, but the other three kept on. Pete threw the butcher knife, and it stuck quivering in the wall. Frankie skimmed a plate and cup after the clock. The mice were all out of sight by now.
"I know what," Chet said. "Here, Frankie, you take my .22. I'll use the horse pistol, and Pete's got his air gun. Bill can yank the mattress up and jump back, and we can all blaze at once."
Bill said, "What if old Angus MacLeod came around here and caught you? He looks after this place for Tex."
"Oh, Angus," Chet said. "He's so tight every time he farts he whistles."
They all laughed. He looked around and saw them laughing, and with a dead-eyed Dick draw, he yanked up the horse pistol and aimed it at the bed.
"Come on, Bill," he said. "You'd shoot me," Bill said. "I don't want to bust up Tex's shack anyway."
"You help bust the window?" Chet said.
"What are you such a sissy for?"
"I ain't a sissy."
"You sure act like one," Pete said.
"It ain't fair," Bill said. "You'd all get to shoot and I wouldn't."
"You can have second shot with my .22, Chet said. "Frankie'll shoot and then you can."
Bill hesitated.
"Well, all right," he said. "But don't any of you shoot till I get out of the way."
He walked over to the bunk, eyeing them.
"Wait till I get clear out of the way now."
He stooped, still watching them, yanked the mattress over the edge and jumped clear. 2 mice dropped out of a wide hole and darted for the corner. Another one dashed from under the bed. The air rifle went off, then the .22. The mice switched back toward the bed. Chet held the pistol with both hands and pulled the trigger. There was a tremendous roar. The gun kicked clear up over his head and almost out of his hands. The 4 stared. The mice had vanished, but there was a great splintered gash in the floor.
"Holy cow," Chet said.
For a moment, the damage that one slug had done to the boards shocked them silent. How would you like to get shot with a thing like that? It would make a hole through you could put your hand into. Bill was staring with his eyes wide and scared.
"Jiminy," he said.
He looked at Chet.
"I'm going to get out of here," he said, and bolted.
Frankie reached out a toe and scuffed at the splinters the .44 bullet had ripped from the floor. They looked at each other, almost holding their breath. Then the impulse struck them almost simultaneously. They yelled. They fired their guns into the sodden mattress. They tipped over the table and spilled magazines and candle ends onto the floor.
"Let's burn the damn place down," Chet said.
He shot the .44 into the bed again, and a mouse ran out. They cornered and killed it, ripped the mattress into the middle of the room, kicked at the mice that scattered frantically. Frankie wrenched till he got a leg off the table, and with that for a club, he beat down the shelves. From the doorway, the scared face of Bill watched them.
"Burn her down," Chet said. "Break her all to pieces."
He smashed a chair against the wall and splintered one leg, threw the whole thing on the pile. Pete was bending down, trying to light the mattress, soggy with winter damp.
"I need some paper," he said.
The air was immediately full of crumpled sheets of paper. Pete twisted a handful, lighted the feathered end, and stuck it under the pile of broken furniture and rubbish. The flame caught, grew. Chet looked at Frankie and wet his lips. He shifted the .44 to his other hand and moved over by the door.
"You guys are going to catch it," Bill said from outside.
"Aw, bull," Chet said. He wet his lips again and watched Frankie doing a war dance around the fire. The shack was beginning to get smoky, and the smoke was exciting. Chet leaped after Frankie, waving the gun. He struck a pose by the window and stood, crouching, the gun in his belt, his hand like a claw.
"I'm Buck Duane," he said. "I'm the old Lone Star Ranger. Any of you outlaws looking for me?"
He looked around the shack, slowly, contemptuously, eyes narrowed and mouth a slit. The others were all watching.
"I guess I'll just shoot your lights out anyway," Chet said, "seeing you're all too yellow to come on."
He snatched for the gun in a lightning draw, but the front sight caught in a belt loop, and he had to tug it loose. He fired twice into the ceiling, and Pete, by the door, pretended he was shot, clutching at his breast and staggering loosely around the floor. Frankie stuck out his foot, and Pete almost fell in the fire. He arose, full of wrath.
"Watch out who you go tripping." "A bourgeois," Frankie said.
Pete shouldered him sideways.
"Bourgeois nothing. You watch out who you go tripping around into fires."
"Who'll make me?"
"I'll make you."
"You and whose army?"
Frankie said.
"I don't need any army."
Their hands were up. They were sparring lightly, shuffling around in the corner where the table had been. Chet coughed in the smoke.
"Come on outside and settle it," he said. "We're going to get our pants burned off in here."
The quarrelers started out just as Bill, his eyes bugging out and his jaw so loose that he could hardly speak, stuck his head inside and shouted something.
"What?"
Chet said. He pushed past Bill, Frankie and Pete on his heels, shouldering each other angrily in the doorway. Bill yelled again and pointed. A wagon was coming up the hill, hardly more than 2 blocks away, and in the wagon was Angus MacLeod and his whole family. Even as they stared, Angus was tossing the reins to his wife and jumping to the ground. Bill and Frankie broke together around the smoking shack, Chet and Pete a step behind, hitting for the aspen coulee that came down close. After 10 steps, Frankie stopped, digging, and legged it back, to come after the other three in a moment, pushing his bicycle on the dead run. By the time Frankie reached the edge of the protecting brush, Angus, tall, red-headed, and surprisingly fast, was around the house. He didn't even stop to look inside or put out the fire. Fists doubled, red hair blowing, he covered ground like a galloping horse, so that there never was a chance of getting the bike away. A block inside the brush, Frankie wheeled it into a clump of bushes and came pounding after Chet, burdened down with his 2 guns. Bill and Pete were out of sight, maybe still running, maybe hiding. The grade got steeper. Chet's mouth was dry, his eyes bulging, his chest on fire for air. Once when the trees thinned, they heard Angus yell and looked back to see him coming with that terrible, unsuspected speed. They ducked up a side trail, raced across a stretch of level ground, slid off to the left through straggling brush, and huddled up under the bank of the watercourse, completely spent, trying to swallow the heaving of their breath. They waited, hoping that they had fooled Angus, and in a minute they heard him go thundering by. Even then they stuck where they were. Chet started to whisper to Frankie, but a sound above made him huddle close up against the bank, so close that little clods of dirt broke loose and rolled down past his cheek. Angus was coming back, They heard his steps, heavy, not running now, and his hoarse breath. The steps went straight on down the path, and after 3 minutes, Chet peeked through the roots on the lip of the bank and saw the farmer just disappearing into the trees. Keeping out of sight under the bank, they went back up the coulee, crossed through it onto the east side near the top, and came down through the other coulee to the sand hills. At the edge of the hills, they found Bill and Pete, scared to go on any further till Angus left. They had run clear up onto the bench, and then come down under the cover of the trees.
"Well, by geez," Chet said. "He never caught any of us."
In the low sumac, between the aspen and the sandstone pillars, they lay sprawling on their backs. Chet began to feel pretty good. They had got away slick as a whistle, and he still had the six-shooter, too.
"Never laid a hand on a one of us," he said.
"No," Bill said, "but he's got Frankie's wheel."
Frankie sat up, was pulled down instantly. He opened his mouth and squawked,
"What?"
"I seen him," Bill said. "I seen him come out of the brush pushing the bike. It stood against the shanty now."
They all stared at Frankie. His lip trembled, and a tear popped into each eye.
"What'll Mr. Lipscomb do?" Chet said.
"He'll kill me," Frankie said.
He dashed his forearm across his eyes and bit his lower lip. "You don't know. When he gets mad, he's just as likely to hit me with a stick of type." On hands and knees, he crawled to the very edge of the sumac. The others wriggled up, and they lay in a row, looking across the green slope to the shack. The smoke wasn't going up anymore, but there was a smoldering pile of stuff outside, where Mrs. McLeod and the kids had thrown it. Mrs. McLeod and the children were sitting by the wagon. Angus was hitching his horses to the plow he had brought along, and Frankie's wheel was leaning against the corner of the shack.
"Oh, damn," Frankie said.
He lay down in the brush with his face on his arms. Chet, looking over the six-shooter, rolling the empty cylinder, peering down the fouled barrel, thought darkly that they ought to go right down there and throw a gun on old McLeod and take the bike and tell him to hit the grit. He would do just that if he had any more bullets. He would throw his gun from low on his thigh, and it would come so fast Angus wouldn't even see it. "All right, McLeod," he would say, "give the kid back his bike and don't take your time either." He stole a look at Frankie. Once on a hike, he had seen old man Lipscomb, who was the scoutmaster, get mad at Frankie and slap him so hard on the jaw that the red mark stayed there for an hour. Frankie would get Hail Columbia now. Frankie raised up a little.
"We got to get it back," he said doggedly. "I wouldn't dast go home without it, and I ought to be there now."
"Well, how?" Chet said.
"I ain't gonna help," Bill said. "I didn't want to bust up Texas shack in the first place."
"You're a coward," Frankie said.
"I ain't either. I just don't want anything to do with it."
"Me neither," Pete said. "Any guy that'd shove you in a fire—"
"Oh, quit arguing," Chet said.
He was remembering an Indian story he had been reading in The American Boy, where one hunter had drawn the Indian's fire while the other got away and went for help.
"Look it," he said. "Come on over here."
They all crawled to the edge again.
"See, if you could get into the brush on this side, then the rest of us could go around on the other side and make a racket and get Angus chasing us, and then you could dash out and get on your bike and beat it."
"I'm game,"
Frankie said. His face was smeared and his mouth tight.
"Who's coming?"
"Not me,"
Bill said.
"Me neither," said Pete. "I'm not helping any guy that tries to push a guy in the fire."
Frankie half raised up.
"Oh, for gosh sakes," he said. "I'll smack you in the nose."
"Try it," Pete said. "I dare you. Go on and smack me."
They lay on their elbows, glowering, and Chet got mad at both of them.
"You can fight any old time," he said. "We gotta get that wheel."
So he and Frankie went alone, Chet feeling loyal and heroic and contemptuous of the two left behind. He left his two guns with Pete so he could run faster if Angus took after him, and he and Frankie worked back down through the coulee until they could hear the cries of Angus' two little girls playing.
"Now I'll sneak on across," Chet whispered. "You watch, and when you see the bushes jerk, get ready. Then I'll jump up and see if I can get him after me, and you grab the bike."
Stealthily, he snaked through the golden bright shadows of the aspen and into the fringe of sumac. Lifting his head carefully, he could see Angus plowing the potato patch he grew on Texas land every year, and Mrs. Angus spreading out some lunch in the shade of the wagon. None of them was within 100 feet of the bike. He jerked the bushes, and a bush across the opening, hardly 50 feet from the shack, twitched back. Chet drew a long breath, trying to unknot his stomach. He waited until Angus was plowing in his direction, as far from Frankie and the bicycle as he would get. Then he jumped to his feet, yelled, waved his arms, and thumbed his nose. Angus did not hesitate a second. He dropped the reins from around his neck, turned the plow on its side, and started like a foot racer for Chet. Out of the corner of his eye, before his legs could answer his command to bolt, Chet saw Frankie run crouching to the corner of the shack, and then he himself turned tail and dug for the woods. He had only gone a few steps when Mrs. Angus yelled. He threw a scared, running look over his shoulder. Angus had turned and was trying to cut Frankie off as he pushed the wheel desperately across the bumpy ground toward the road. Chet stopped and watched, hardly breathing. Frankie had 50 yards to go before he hit the trail and ground smooth enough to ride on, and Angus, coming down at an angle, had a good chance to cut him off. Frankie sprinted, bouncing the wheel, his bare legs and fallen stockings twinkling, but Angus was coming like a thunderbolt. Chet's heart stopped for a full 2 seconds as Frankie hit the road and made a running leap onto the seat. It looked as if Angus could reach out in one more stride and grab him. He had looked terribly fast before, coming uphill. Now, going down, he was all legs. He opened up clear to the neck like a clothespin. He ate up 20 feet at a stride. Frankie's head was down, his feet on the pedals were a blur, his shirt was ballooning out behind, but he did not open up any daylight between himself and Angus. One bump, one spill, and Frankie was a goner. But he didn't spill, and he didn't let up. And even at the tracks, where he had with providential carelessness left both gates open, he pedaled right on, bumped perilously over the planks of the crossing, and legged it out the other side and up the road to town. Angus stopped at the fence. Chet yelled, cheered, waved to Frankie far down below. When he took his eyes off the flying white figure and woke up to where he was, Mrs. Angus was only a few rods away, bearing down on him with her face puckered in anger. Like a scared antelope, Chet cut for the woods. At first he didn't really fear her much. Then, a little way inside the aspen, he glanced back to see her almost upon him. She was almost as fast as Angus. Fear put a spurt of speed in Chet's legs, but he couldn't shake her. He heard her feet pounding on the path behind, close upon him. In a minute her hand might reach out. Like a flash, he dropped to hands and knees. Mrs. Angus's heavy knee hit him solidly, knocking his wind half out, and she went over him ponderously, grabbing for him as she fell. But Chet scrambled loose and escaped like a limping, winded fox into the brush. When Chet got home from that expedition, he hid the six-shooter in the cellar and kept his mouth discreetly shut, waiting to see what would happen. A time or two he slipped home from school at noon, when he knew his mother would be down at the post office seeing if there was a letter from Pa, and took out the gun to snap and fondle it. But it came Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and nothing happened. Angus wasn't going to raise a fuss, or maybe he didn't know who to raise it at. He and Frankie had started building an elaborate shanty in the brush by the East Ford. Pete came in over Frankie's protest when he produced a full bag of Bull Durham stolen from his father. Bill came in, too, on the strength of a half a raisin pie he had got from home. They camouflaged the shanty with brush, disguised the path in. And on Thursday afternoon, Chet proposed that they take the six-shooter down and have some target practice. Shells for a .44 probably cost plenty, so everybody'd have to divvy in. A quick foray under the plank sidewalk in front of the hotel turned up a dime and a good deal of tea lead. Crawling out, they scattered to their homes to see what could be raised. In half an hour, all were back. Bill had a dime. Pete had hooked 17 cents from his father's second-best pants. Frankie had only 4 pennies. Mr. Lipscomb wouldn't give him any money, and he was scared to hook any. Chet had bummed a dime from his mother. Altogether, they had 51 cents.
"I should think that'd be enough," Chet said.
He shifted his pants because the 44 was inside them and kept slipping down. On their way to the hardware store, they ran into Bruce, going to mail a letter for Ma. That was the second one she had sent in 2 days.
"Don't you go following us," he warned Bruce.
"Why? What you gonna do?"
"None of your business. You just stay away is all."
"I guess I can walk where I want to," Bruce said.
"You're too little to hang around with us," Chet said, and hitched his pants. The string that hung the gun around his neck was cutting into him. He walked a little spraddling to keep the pistol from banging against his stomach. They ditched Bruce and went into the hardware. Mr. McGregor's pale, egg-like, bald head came forward along the dark counter. On a nail keg sat Jewel King, hugging his knees.
"Hi, Mr. King," Chet said.
"Hi, boy," King said. "Been throwing any parties lately?"
"No, sir," Chet said. He wished he could forget that Mr. King was town marshal, and he wished he hadn't brought the gun along in here. It was so dark that probably the little bulge it made wasn't noticeable, but it bothered him anyway, and he crowded against the counter.
"Have you got any 44 cartridges?" he said to Mr. McGregor. Mr. McGregor bent over the counter.
"You mean 45, don't you?"
"No, 44.
"That's an old-fashioned size," Mr. McGregor said. "If you really want anything that big, you must want 45s. What do you want them for?"
"It's for a gun of paws," Chet said. "It's 44, I know."
Mr. McGregor looked across at Jewel King, his toothless mouth wrinkled up like the mouth of a paper bag.
"You ever see a 44, Jewel?"
"Sure," Jewel said. "They make 'em all right."
He let his knee down and said to Chet,
"You haven't got the gun handy, have you? Maybe we could tell."
Chet swallowed. Jewel King was looking at him from one side, Mr. McGregor from the other. Bruce had come in and was standing by the door.
"No," Chet said. "I haven't got the gun. I just wanted some to...
Jewel's hand came out suddenly and patted him around the waist, felt the gun, dragged it out, broke the string. He looked the pistol over and showed it to Mr. McGregor. Mr. McGregor nodded his head up and down.
"Give themselves away every time," he said.
Jewel spoke sadly to Chet, who was standing frozen, not trying to run.
"I'm sorry to do this, boy," Jewel said, "but I've got to arrest you. You stole that gun from Tex Davis's place, didn't you?"
Chet swallowed. The door slammed, and he turned his head quickly. Frankie and Pete and Bill had all skipped, and only Bruce stood inside the door.
"Yes, sir,"
Chet said. Mr. McGregor munched his gums together and cackled.
"Hey, God, it's funny," he said. "Both in jail the same time. That's a funny one."
"What?"
Chet said. Jewel King looked at him soberly.
"Don't you know?"
"Know what?"
"Never mind," Jewel said. "I'll have to take you over to the jail, and then I'll have to go see your mother. I don't like to see you in a mess like this, Chet. I had a pretty high opinion of you up till now."
As they started for the door, Bruce, pale and weeping, turned and fled. When they got out on the street, Chet saw him streaking along the irrigation ditch toward home.
Chapter 7
"He said that?"
Elsa rose slowly from the chair in the kitchen and stared at Bruce. He nodded, sniffling.
"But how could he know," she said, half to herself, "when I just got the letter today? He just took hold of Chet and said, 'I'm sorry, boy, but I've got to arrest you.' And then Mr. McGregor said that about both of them at the same time. Is Pa in jail, Ma?"
Elsa put her hand in her apron pocket and felt the letter.
"No,"
she said.
"What are they going to do to Chet?"
"Never mind," she said. "You run out and play. I'll go get Chet straightened out."
"I want to come, Ma,"
she said. "You stay as far out of this as you can get. I'll be back pretty soon." Along the ditch bank, as she went uptown, there were purple crocuses, and the primroses were just beginning to fold their petals together. A chilly little wind blew in from the river. "So now everything's falling apart," she said. "Now Beau's in jail in Haver, and Chet's in jail at home. And we're right back where we started in Dakota, only worse now, with the kids in it." Walking, she pulled out the letter and read it again. Two policemen had been waiting at the line, picked him up before he could get across. He was full of shame. He couldn't blame himself enough for bringing this on her. They had confiscated the car and the load and had him charged with smuggling. "I should have listened to you, sis," he wrote. "But I wanted so damn much to get out of the hole. If I could have made a good stake at this, we could have gone anywhere you wanted and settled down to some steady business. I was just sick of living on sow belly and beans in a dirty little jerkwater town, I guess. They've got me in jail with a nigger, but I'm not complaining. I'm no better than a nigger the way I've made you live. I hope you won't think you have to tell the kids. If this turns out all right, I'll make it up to you. That's a promise." She put the letter away again. "Don't tell the kids." At the jail, she found Jewel King.
"I was just going to call you," he said, "but I thought I better let Chet stew a while in the jailhouse."
He chuckled, and his belly shook.
"He's got guts, that kid," he said. "Most kids would have bawled, but he just sits there and grits his teeth. I like to see a kid like that."
"Do you like to see a boy steal?"
"Oh, steal," Jewel said. "This wasn't really stealing. Any kid would snitch a gun if he found it in a deserted shanty. He's just full of beans. I wouldn't have put him in the cooler, only Angus McLeod was pretty hot. Said a bunch of 'em swiped the gun and some other stuff and then tried to burn the house down."
"Oh, Lord," Elsa said. "Did they?"
"No, Angus come along and put it out."
Jewel fished up a bent cigar.
"I wouldn't worry, Elsa. Chet wasn't the only one. We got the gun back, and if you give Angus $4 or $5 damages, everything's all right."
"Who are the others?"
"I don't know. Chet wouldn't tell."
"But he stole the gun himself."
"I guess so. He had it on him."
"All right," she said. "I'll give you $5 for Angus. Chet was the ringleader. He always is. I want him to spend the night in jail."
"Oh, now that ain't necessary," Jewel said.
"I want him to stay in jail anyway," Elsa said. "I want him to learn what it means to break laws and get in trouble."
She met Jewel's queer, sidelong look steadily.
"Now can I see him a minute?" she said.
He led her into the little cell back of the firehouse, where Chet slumped on a bench. He rose when the door opened, and Elsa felt a pang at the sight of his face, white and set and too old for him. "Like father, like son," she thought. Shame and sullenness and eagerness for sympathy and determination to act like a man, whatever happened. His face said exactly the same things as Beau's letter.
"Well, Chet," she said.
"Hello, Ma."
"I never expected to see you in a jail," she said. He stood sullenly silent.
He would not, she saw, attempt to deny his guilt or plead with her. There again he was like Beau. He was what he was, and he wouldn't pretend to be anything else. Bruce would have lied in the same situation. Chet might much more likely go clear wrong, but he'd go in his own way, with a kind of pride.
"I hope you realize what you've done," she said. "I wouldn't like to see a boy of mine grow up a thief."
She stopped then, because she didn't want to add the humiliation of tears to his punishment. "Mr. King will let you out in the morning in time for breakfast," she said. "You come home and eat and get ready for school." Chet turned and sat down on the bench, and to keep from crying herself, she brushed past Jewel and went outside.
"I'd rather spend the night in there myself than make him do it," she said.
"Yeah," Jewel said. "Well, I'll see that Diamond Dick gets back home all right. Don't worry about the jail. That's a good, clean jail, no bugs or anything."
Will he have to sleep on that bench? I didn't see any bed.
Bed in the firehouse part, he said. He'll be okay.
All right. She looked hard at Jewel. But don't you be too easy on him. Don't give him the idea that what he's done is smart or manly or anything. I want him to know that being in jail is a disgrace.
So now there would be waiting again, as it seemed to her she had waited all the time she had known Beau. Now there would be sitting day after day, busying herself with little unimportant things, but jumping at the slightest noise, running to the window at the slightest flash of movement along the south road. There would be getting through the day somehow, anyhow, getting the boys to bed, sitting in the evenings to do fancy work or to read, and her ears twice as alert as in daylight, her mind twice as receptive to frettings and worry. They would be dragging off to bed with the worries waiting for her to lie down, hanging over her like mosquitoes on a warm night. There would be the escapes she had used before, the daydreams and the memories of childhood that sometimes were so similar that they confused her, pictures of quiet streets, apple trees heavy with fruit or white with blossoms in a green backyard, her children scuffling leaves under the maples and running to greet Beau when he came down the sidewalk on a summer evening coming from work with his coat on his arm and the 6 o'clock sun on his face. That dream expanded indefinitely. Neighbors dropped in for root beer and whist. Beau told stories, did card tricks, sang songs, kept them all laughing. There were good nights of tenderness and love, and in the mornings, Beau's voice singing a fool song. She didn't want much. Yet it seemed to her sometimes as if life had conspired to keep from her exactly that one thing that she desired, and as if her husband and her children, who were the single indispensable part of her daydreams, should be the ones to destroy what she had been working for. One night she sat reading a novel that someone had loaned her. It was all about castaways on a cannibal island, and war with wooden swords between the tribes, and it was romantic and exciting and a little silly. But she kept at it because if she didn't, she would have to think. Once her head lifted. It sounded like someone out behind, but there had been too many of those false alarms lately. Her ears were like the ears of a dog pricking in sleep at phantasmal noises. Then she heard it again, distinctly. She stood up just as the door between the dining room and kitchen opened, and Beau's grinning face looked in. She dropped the book and ran to him, was swept into his bear hug. When he set her down and she could look at his face, his eyes were sly and warm.
"Hi, Mama," he said. "How've you been?"
"Oh, all right," she said. She had him by the arms, looking him over. There was something different about him, something gayer and younger. His clothes. "Why, you've got a new suit," she said.
"Like it?"
"It's lovely, but what... I thought... How did everything come out?"
"Did you think they'd hang me?"
His laugh was so open and amused that she stared. There was no such shame as she had expected, no hangdog look of creeping home in disgrace, and she realized instantly, though the idea had never entered her head before, that she had been counting on that, expecting to steer him with it as she had steered Chet.
"What happened over there?" she said.
He laughed again.
"They had to turn me loose. Didn't have any business pinching me in the first place. The American Prohibition Law isn't in effect yet, see? They pinched me on the wrong side of the line. The cops just got all snarled up about what their job was. So after they'd kept me in jail a week or so, they had to give me back the car and the load."
"But how could they be so stupid? If there wasn't any law..."
"They didn't know what the law is yet. That's their trouble. Neither did I. I was piping pretty small till my lawyer put me wise. He was a smart little shyster."
He shook her fondly by the shoulders and narrowed his eyes, grinning.
"Want to see something?"
"Sure, what?"
"Where's the lantern?"
"I'll get it. What have you got?"
"Wait and see."
With an air of great secrecy, he lighted the lantern.
"And you didn't have to pay a fine or anything?" she said, going out.
"Nary a nickel. Go on, keep moving. Right on out to the shed.
The shed doors were open, but Bo muffled the lantern so that she could see nothing.
Open your mouth and shut your eyes, he said.
You're just like a child, she said. Unexpected returns and surprises and mysteries. What is this?
Now you can open.
She opened. There was a car in the shed that was not the old Ford. It was new, expensive-looking. Bo had turned on the headlights, which burned with a white brilliance against the shed wall and reflected back on the gleaming dark green of the body.
"My goodness," Elsa said. "Where did you get this?"
"Bought it."
"Bought it? With what?"
"With $1,700.
"What?"
"Take it easy," he said. "There's plenty more where that came from."
"Well, I just don't understand," she said.
She inspected the mysterious dials on the dashboard, wiggled the gear shift knob, read the name on the plate. Essex. It was by all odds the finest car she had ever seen. The seats were grained leather. The top was black and rakish as a taut sail.
"A new suit and a car that cost $1,700, she said.
She lifted the blankets in the back of the car and looked under.
"And another load."
"And that isn't all," Bo said. "Come on back inside."
He shut off the headlights and locked the shed doors. On the way to the house, he laid his arm across her shoulders and shook her again.
"Got your eyes bugging out, haven't I?"
"You've mystified me enough," she said. "I give up. Now tell me quick." Inside the kitchen, he blew out the lantern with a sharp puff of breath and let the chimney down. In the light of the lamp on the table, his eyes were bright as a cat's. "I had almost 2,000 when I left here," he said.
"And you've spent it all."
"Don't get ahead of yourself.
I put 1,500 in a Haver bank and got a load and started back. That's when they pinched me and took me back to Haver. And in jail I met a guy that put me wise."
"The nigger?"
He looked at her in disgust.
"No, not the nigger. All he did was teach me to play coon can. This was a guy that got pinched in a gambling raid. After I got through talking to him and they let me out, I went out and traded old Lena in on this boat and moved the load from one to the other and bought some more to fill this one up, and there she is."
"But if it cost $1,700,
"I got $450 for Lena," Bo said, "and I gave them $250 cash. We owe $1,000 on her."
"But what are we going to use it for? I'd feel silly riding around this town in a car like that."
"Maybe you won't be riding around this town," Bo said. "This boat will go twice as fast as old Lena, and she holds half again as much. She'll pay for herself before you can spit twice."
"You're going on running whiskey," Elsa said.
He nodded, watching her.
"Till I get so far ahead I can afford to get out," he said. "You know what we're going to do?"
"I can imagine."
"We're going to move."
"Where to?"
"One of the Montana towns, Haver or Great Falls."
"And leave the homestead and this house and the stock?"
"Hell with all of it," Bo said. "The hell with this little burg, too.
Soon as that prohibition law goes into effect in the states, there'll be millions to be made.
There is now. Some of the states are already dry, and there's always a market in a dry state. We're going to run whiskey where there's money to pay for it in wholesale lots."
Elsa stood quietly, everything in her sagging, as if she had worked all day and saw more work ahead that had to be done before she could rest.
"I wish..."
"Huh?"
"What if they had convicted you in Haver?"
"They didn't," Bo said. "And they won't ever get the chance again, not as long as I've got a fast car."
His eyes were steady on hers, as if he dared her to raise an objection, as if he had arguments and statistics and proofs to counteract anything she could say. She sighed and gave it up. Bo seemed to feel the moment when her resistance disintegrated. He swung around the kitchen as if shaking the whole thing from his back and yelled for food. While she got him something, he sat at the table, natty and citified in his new clothes. He told her that he had stopped out on the bench and changed so as to come in with all flags flying, and watched her slyly. His hand was in his coat pocket. Absently, when she set the food before him, he picked up her left hand and looked at it,
bent the knuckles tentatively forward and back, smoothed out the skin.
Nice little hand you've got there.
Nice and red and rough.
No, he said. You've got nice hands.
Now what do you want? She said.
Just to prettify it a little, Beau said.
He brought a small package out of his pocket. Inside the paper was a jeweler's plush box, and inside the box was a tiny gold watch. She looked at it, at him, back at it, and suddenly she was crying. Beau came around the table and put his arm around her, whispering into her hair.
"Take it easy," he whispered. "I just wanted you to know how much I appreciate you've been swell."
She said no more that night about the whiskey business she had been determined to steer him out of. She couldn't. Instead, she sat and listened to him talk about what they were going to do and see, the money they were going to make. He opened up the future like a Christmas package for her delight, and he was so delighted himself that she couldn't be otherwise.
"We've been stuck in this backwater too long," he said. "You're going back where there are lawns and trees and cement sidewalks and automobiles that make that one out there look like a donkey cart. You're going to have a fur coat and nice clothes, and you aren't going to make them yourself either. The kids are going to a high school, and I'm smoking nothing but 2 for a quarter cigars, starting now. We've been chasing pipe dreams too long. This is the time we make it. Go!"
Chapter 8
For a week, they were a wonder. When Beau drove the Essex downtown and parked it, a crowd gathered. Boys ran their hands over the finish. Men lifted the hood and bent in over the motor, stood back respectfully when Beau climbed in and stepped on the self-starter. They examined it from front to rear, their faces closed, their eyes veiled. They kicked the tires. They listened to the idling motor. They unscrewed the radiator cap and looked in. They asked casually how fast she'd go and how good she was on hills. They commented on her lines, her color, her mechanical perfections. Some said, oh, hell, she wasn't anything but a cheap Hudson. But they watched like the others when she went by. In that week, Elsa had 1,000 things to do. There was the house to clean out, clothes to pack, books to box. Beau sold the 2 cows to Hank Freeze on the north bench. The horses he couldn't sell, so he left them with the oldest Heathcliff boy to keep for half the increase. For the house there was no market at all. George McKenna at the store finally agreed to try to sell it for them. The wholesale sellout brought up the question of Bruce's colt. It was getting no better. As it grew, it threw more weight on the broken legs, and its walk was the same floundering lunge it had had when they found it in the bend. Jim Enoch came over to see Beau about it, and with Bruce hanging anxiously on the fringes of their talk, they looked the colt over. Beau's eyes went to Bruce, rubbing the colt's neck under the long sorrel mane. He drew Enoch aside, but Bruce left his pet and followed. Patting his pockets, Beau pretended to hunt for something. "Run inside and get me a couple cigars." Bruce looked suspiciously from one to the other, hesitated, then turned and darted away.
"Worth anything at all?" Beau said.
Enoch spat.
"Hide."
Beau breathed angrily through his nose.
"I never should have let the kid get attached to it," he said. "He's all wrapped up in it now."
"It ain't a very pleasant thing to do," Enoch said. "I'll take it off your hands if you want. The hide's worth about 3 bucks.
Bruce came running back with the cigars, his eyes swinging from one face to the other. Beau cleared his throat.
"Well," he said, "Jim's willing to make a deal for your colt."
"Couldn't we," Bruce said, "couldn't we take him along, ship him or something?"
"No," Beau said, "we couldn't do that. He'll be better off here. Jim'll take care of him for you. He'll give you $3 for him."
"Oh, gee," Bruce said, "I don't want to sell socks."
"Well, it's either sell him or give him away," Beau said. He squatted down and put his hand on the boy's shoulder. "Look, he said. Maybe we'll be coming back here sometime. Your colt couldn't get along running with the herd over at Heathcliff's, so you'd better sell him to Jim, and if we come back, you can buy him back.
And he'll still be mine?
Sure thing, Enoch said. Bruce broke loose from his father and went over to the colt. He reached up and hugged it around the neck, and it nuzzled his shirt, leaving flecks of moisture on the cloth. The boy reached up to whisper something private in the colt's ear. Then he turned and said,
"All right, I'll sell him to you, Mr. Enoch. He'd rather stay with you than anybody else. He knows you."
He took Enoch's 3 silver dollars and held them uncertainly in his hand.
"Can I come and see him before we go?" he said.
"I'm taking him out to the ranch," Enoch said. "That's pretty far." Over his head, Bo made a motion at Enoch, and Enoch went out to drive his wagon around and back. In 10 minutes, he pulled out again, the half-raised head of the trussed colt showing above the end gate. Bruce ran after the wagon, rubbing the sorrel's nose, the tears shaking big down his face until almost the East Ford. There he stood, waving, seeing through a blur of crying the high-wheeled wagon and the sorrel hide and the blazed white nose, and one rolling, scared eye over the end gate as the wagon went on down the trail and around the curve behind the willows. They gave Spot to the Chance boys. Old Tom was wheeled away one morning in a doll buggy by 3 excited little girls who had dressed his languid, sleepy, gray body in petticoats and tucked him under the covers, where he lay in a most uncat-like position, flat on his back, and purred like a tea kettle.
"I hate to see old Tom go," Elsa said. "He was such a comfortable, sleepy old cat."
"Except when a dog got after him," Chet said. "Remember when Chapman's Airedale treed him in the barn? He went right up in the air and came down on that old Airedale's back with his claws digging like 60. He rode him clear up past Van Damme's."
"He wasn't so sleepy out hunting either," Bruce said. "Remember when we saw him dive into the river on top of the mud hen?"
That was the way of their uprooting.
Remember the time?
5 years in that town had made it home. Elsa wondered if her boys would have the same homesick memories of that barren little river-bottom village as she had of the maple-lined streets and the creamery and the white-steepled church in Indian Falls.
Home was a curious thing, like happiness.
You never knew you had had it until it was gone. You never knew either how many people you thought of with kindness, the people who now met you on the street as you went about pulling up all the little roots that had gone down in 5 years, and shook your hand and said, "Don't forget us. Don't get so prosperous over there in the States that you never remember your old friends." There was no time for regrets. Maybe this whiskey business, for all its illegality, was as good as anything they could have chosen. There were no places on earth anymore where opportunity lay new and shining and untouched. The old days when people used to rush to Dakota or California or Alaska in search of easy wealth were gone forever. She and Bo together had tried 1 or 2 of those worn-out dreams, to their sorrow. But if he could do as well as he said he could at this business, and then get out, he at least would have been preserved from his own irritability and restlessness and bad temper. So she went, carefully pulling up the little roots that gave with a slight, unwilling tug, and left the future to Bo. He was so sure of it. In the sun-slanting, dew-fresh morning, they stood for the last time on the porch, the loaded car nosing the front fence. Not even the rush of packing had ruffled Bo's temper this time. He locked the door, tossed the key in his hand, looked at Elsa, puckered his lips in a jigging whistle, and winked. He rubbed his finger down the door frame. "Goodbye, old paint," he said. Elsa was looking through the front window at the bare room, its raw floor showing inside the frame of painted border. The mantel Bo had put in with the intention of someday building a fireplace under it
was empty of knick-knacks, the picture of three white horses floating maned against a background of storm was gone, and only its clean, oval shape remained on the wall. She touched Beau's arm.
"Let's try," she said. "Let's try awful hard this time."